Oh, hi, Art. This is Arnold from KOWS here in Sebastopol, yes. Sonoma County.
Yes, go right ahead.
Thanks so much for taking the call. I saw the blog about monarchs, and that really gave me a jolt that it's, I suppose, a Dickensian world for monarchs. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. What happened this year?
Well, we don't really understand it yet. We're just beginning to get a grip on where they have been and where they are now. What can be said is that in my part of California, along the I-80 corridor, there have been essentially no monarchs between late May and about 2 weeks ago.
And till 2 weeks ago. Now, what is the norm, if there is such a norm?
Well, that is a good question. Historically, the pattern, you know, I've been here 46 years, so I can't speak before that. But historically, the pattern was that the animals would move inland from their overwintering grounds along the coast. They would arrive here anytime from late February to mid-March. They would breed in the spring here in the Central Valley. And some years breeding would continue through the summer. Some years there would be a hiatus during the hottest part of the year. Monarchs move around constantly, and it's unusual for them to breed in the same place in successive generations. They move around and hit new patches of milkweed. But we were used to that. And then there would be a westward migration beginning typically in August.
Hello.
Sign in monarch abundance, which began in the 90s and continued more or less monotonically downhill. We didn't really understand why until the drought. And during the drought, well, something else happened. Let me backtrack for a minute.
Okay.
When the numbers were going down, we lost the spring breeding. The butterflies would arrive from the coast, but apparently keep going without breeding. And then we wouldn't see them in the Central Valley until late summer and fall, when they would arrive from the east and begin breeding. So instead of having the principal breeding episode being in the spring and early summer, when the numbers were very low, we got most of our breeding in late summer and especially autumn. Most of the caterpillars would be around in September or even October.
Okay,
then the drought occurred. And when the drought occurred, they returned to the previous pattern of breeding in the spring, and the numbers went back up to approximately what they had been before the decline. Okay. And then the drought ended 2 winters ago with a bang. Remember how wet it was. And last year, the numbers began going downhill again. And this year, there was no spring breeding, and the numbers bottomed out at the lowest we've ever seen. So it's been extremely dynamic, both in terms of numbers and in terms of timing. Now, the question is, where have they been breeding? Where have they been going?
Right.
Well, during the earlier decline, we knew that a great deal of breeding was going on in the mountains, as high as 5,000 feet, as if they were skipping the valley altogether and heading to the mountains to breed in the summer, and even going over the Sierra into the Great Basin. And then, during the drought, they more or less stopped breeding in the mountains. And this year, we haven't found any breeding in the mountains either. We know there was some breeding in central Nevada, but not in the vicinity of Reno. You had to go further east. So it's all been very dynamic and very mysterious what's going on.
I think for the layperson, I think most people think, oh, they go up and down both coasts. But from what you're saying, there's many layers of, there's east, west, up and downs all over the place.
Right.
Could you give a thumbnail of where they're going? It sounds like there's, as you said, a very dynamic patterns are going on.
That's right. Now, this year, until the last week or so, when they've begun showing up down here near sea level, most of the monarchs I have seen have been in the Sierra, and they have been moving from east to west for the last few weeks, migrating across the Sierra and Crest from wherever they were breeding in the summer.
Hmm.
So I've been seeing more monarchs at Donner's Summit at 7,000 feet than I've seen on the valley floor.
Wow.
Now, the problem is we need 10,000 people like me all over the landscape to report where they are, because I can only monitor 10 sites, and obviously that is a minute proportion of the potential area where they could be.
Exactly. So you're seeing, yeah, a little pinprick on each, for the whole, yes.
Yeah, now we discovered back at 40 years ago, more or less, that there were isolated locations in the Sierra completely surrounded by coniferous forest, where, for example, there had been an abandoned homestead that had been taken over by milkweed. And the monarchs literally drop out of the sky and colonize it. And because the location is so remote, they have no natural enemies there, and those places can produce large numbers of adults.
Hmm.
And it's only by dumb luck that one discovers such places. There's another such place in the high North Coast Range, not far from Mendocino Pass, which some years produces large numbers of adults at 5,000 feet.
Basically, totally adaptable, it appears.
They're certainly adaptable. The question is whether we're pressing their limits.
Right. Adapting.
We don't really understand what is driving all of this dynamism, except that plainly the climate is involved, because the reversal of dynamics during the drought was almost instantaneous and very dramatic.
With these fires we've had, do they disorientate butterflies in any way, or monarchs? Do you know anything on that?
Well, not that we know of. We know that flying under a pall of smoke is somewhat disorienting. Butterflies fly slowly as if they're having trouble orienting and navigating, but there's no evidence that it produces any population level effects.
Hmm.
Obviously, burning the vegetation is going to have an effect. It may even be beneficial, because milkweed can be a component of post-fire succession. So there may be a boost in milkweed following this. So we'll just have to wait and see. We have butterflies breeding on host plants regenerating in the burnt neighborhood coffee park in Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
It may prove to be a boon for them, because a fire fertilizes the soil. You get vigorous plant growth, and butterflies will exploit that.
Mm. I've been interviewing the people who are in Coffee Park regularly about their progress. I will have to tell them about watching out for the milkweed there.
But you can tell them the following, which is very interesting. Do you know a plant called butterfly bush, genus Buddleia?
Yeah.
Landscaping shrub?
Sure.
Commonly planted because it attracts butterflies as a nectar source?
Yeah.
Well, it is also a host plant of the larvae of the variable checker spot, Euphydrius chalcedona, which is a fairly common butterfly in the foothills.
Mm.
And the plants that burned in Coffee Park in the fire survived and regenerated. And this year, the females have been coming in and laying eggs on them and breeding happily on them.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Despite all that, they can still find them amongst all that. That is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why they've survived all these hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, well, they've survived more turbulent climatic change than what we're having right now.
Hmm.
But, of course, they didn't have to contend with residential subdivisions. They didn't have to contend with freeways as impediments to movement. They didn't have to contend with pesticides. So we have complicated their survival strategy.
A very good point. And that's really, I suppose, why I know you have a lot of people who report from their backyard reporters all over to help you out in that cause.
Well, I don't have such a network, but such networks exist, and I get an average of 3 or 4 emails a week from people either asking what the hell is going on or telling me what they're observing. So I get inputs, but I don't try to organize a network of informants.
Just on an aside thing, a while back I interviewed somebody who's on dragonflies.
Yeah.
And she mentioned that it was quite fascinating that her theory was that dragonflies, well, they migrate, and then in fact they taught birds how to migrate. I'm just wondering how butterflies come into that picture, if you've ever thought of that.
Well, I have no idea whether there's any relationship between butterfly migration and bird migration, but those of us interested in butterfly migration have been fascinated by the recent discovery that the Painted Lady, which we have here, which is almost globally distributed and migratory everywhere, actually crosses the Sahara Desert to breed during the winter in the Sahel, south of the Sahara, and then they fly back north, cross the Mediterranean, and colonize Europe in the spring. We're talking a 1,500 or 2,000 mile movement.
Wow.
Across one of the most hostile landscapes on the planet.
In that respect, I think a lot of people do get confused about the migrations of monarchs in terms of a lot of people think, oh, they go all the way from Canada to Mexico every year. But
but east of the Rockies, it's the eastern population go to Mexico.
And so where do the western population go?
The California coast, from the North Bay south to southern coast of California. They overwinter in eucalyptus groves and pine groves and so forth along the coast. Places like Monterey, Natural Bridges State Beach, various locations along the coast.
Okay, so they're not affected by that, by in the mountains of Mexico, obviously, where the... they come from the East Coast to those?
There seems to be some slight interchange in individuals between the East and West populations, but California butterflies do not normally go to Mexico. Maybe 0.01% do, but very unusual, and it's only marginally documented. So our butterflies go to the coast. I'll add that when you read in the op-ed pages of their newspaper, that the monarchs are facing crisis because there is a shortage of milkweed. There is absolutely no evidence of any shortage of milkweed in California. There's no harm in people planting milkweed, but it won't do any good either. As it happens, this year is the biggest milkweed year I have ever seen in California, but it's not being used because there are no butterflies to lay eggs on it.
Having a party and nobody turns up.
Right, right.
Next year it could be the opposite. There could be zillions of butterflies and no milkweed.
Well, we would love to be able to make such predictions with some level of confidence, but right now we can't. I can tell you that before the reversal, that is, before the wet winter 2 years ago, the overwintering populations were very, very large, the largest they had been in years, and we had overwintering clusters in places where they'd never been seen before, like Aquatic Park in Berkeley and on Mare Island near Vallejo and so forth. And now there aren't any.
Wow. So, and this is like in your, 46 years, these were all new places then?
Right, and this year is the lowest number of monarch sightings, I think, in my entire history in California.
Wow, that's pretty scary. I would say.
Well, we don't yet know what it means. I have ideas, but I'm not proving them about publicly, because if you float an untested hypothesis, it gets wings and gets into the media and public consciousness and is accepted as if it were truth. So I'm sitting on my ideas until we can test them.
Well, let's talk about you a bit. 46 years just doing this. Could you tell me what was the inspiration for you in your early life to go into this and to obviously continue it with such a passion?
Well, I can tell you that as an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, I did a project at a place called the Tinicum Marsh in southwest Philadelphia, which served as a prototype or a template for this, and conceived the notion of doing it on a longer time scale. Then I went to graduate school and did not have the opportunity to pursue such a project while pursuing my PhD. But when I got a job in California with its Mediterranean climate, it was the ideal environment to do this, and I immediately set about doing it in 1972. The idea was to do it for 5 years, which would be a minimum amount of time to do proper statistical analysis of the results. And if I didn't get tenure and had to move on, at least I would have a 5-year study under my belt. But I did get tenure, and for reasons I'll be glad to expand on if you're interested, I continued the project open-endedly, and here we are.
I would love to hear.
Well, you probably don't know that Sacramento has the longest continuous weather records of any place on the Pacific coast. They go back to the Gold Rush, to 1849. And although there are the usual problems of interpretation, as the location of the weather station has moved, the urban heat island has been generated, blah, 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 if you examine just the long-term precipitation record for Sacramento, you observe a very interesting pattern, which I observed. One of the first things I did when I arrived here was to obtain the climatological data for Sacramento and begin looking at them statistically. Okay, what happens is the precipitation records fall into three groups. In the late Gold Rush period and down to the 1870s, there was immense variation in year-to-year precipitation here. So much so, there's a statistical term called autocorrelation, which measures the degree to which successive measurements of the same thing are correlated with one another. It tells you how much you can use last year's datum to predict this year's, okay?
Okay.
And the autocorrelation was very, very low. The predictability of precipitation was very low. And the occurrence of extremes, both wet and dry, was very frequent. Okay?
Okay.
Then, around the 1880s and extending down through the first few decades of the 20th century, the amount of variability dropped off immensely. Precipitation became much more predictable from year to year, but also the average went way down. It was a long, dry period. Okay?
Okay.
And then, right about the time I arrived here, right around 1970, it went right back to the 19th century pattern, and that's the way it has stayed. So that was exceedingly fascinating, and the very high variability in everything since I arrived provided a perfect environment for doing statistical analysis. So the data were too good to stop collecting them, and I continued.
Yeah, it seems to be a cycle of about 50 years, isn't it? Excuse me.
I have to bring up the graphic on the computer screen and look at it again. I actually gave a public lecture on all of this last night and showed that particular graphic to the audience, and they immediately got it. All you have to do is look at it, and you can see the pattern.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, if you do the same thing with Sierra and snowfall, say at Donner Summit, it's not a good match. You would think that Sierra and snowfall would be well correlated with valley rainfall, but it isn't. And the reason for that is the that the characteristics of the snowpack depend on the temperature during the winter. In warm winters, you get maximum snowfall per event. So you get the maximum snow out of an air mass if the temperature is right at freezing. Mm-hmm. And the colder it is, the more you get light, fluffy powder with low water content. Okay?
Okay.
So the result is that very, very wet years may not correspond with very, very snowy years, and very, very snowy years may not correspond with very wet years. So the two time series have to be analyzed separately.
And then, yeah, then you got to mash the two together to get those migratory patterns going east and west.
And you also have, okay, my transect goes right across the Sierra, so I have 10 places where I monitor the fauna, and they range from sea level to tree line. And so we're in a position to observe the degree to which species behave differently at different altitudes, whether you're dealing with species-specific characteristics or site-specific characteristics in the response to climate, okay? It's a very nice setup from a statistical standpoint.
It is. That is nice to be able to see such clarity there and be able to then analyze it from that. That is
right.
Rare.
We've generated about 24 papers so far from this.
It's the small picture to the big picture. It's all got to be looked at holistically, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it takes an unimaginative person like me, a one-trick pony who does the same thing year after year after year, to generate a data set like this. There are very few such data sets in existence for anything.
You're cited in various worldwide studies and things.
Well, for butterflies, the only comparable data set, although they have proliferated and there are dozens, if not hundreds, of butterfly monitoring programs worldwide now. But the only one of similar antiquity and scope to mine is the British one, which was started about the same time. It's organized very differently, and it's dealing with a much smaller fauna with only 58 or 59 species of butterflies in the whole UK. But the time scale is very similar, and we actually find, for example, that the species which is most responsive statistically to temperature change is the same one in the UK and in California.
And which is that?
The Red Admiral, and it's Atalanta.
Oh, I remember that growing up in England. Yeah, it was about the most common.
Well, interestingly, in California, to a considerable extent, it's an urban species breeding on, well, in the coastal fog belt, it breeds on a weed, a naturalized weed called pellitory, that grows in very seedy places, like under freeway overpasses where the homeless camp.
In people's backyards, what can people do to help in either promoting monarchs and their flow, and also, you know, the reporting and being aware of what's happening?
Well, actually not very much. Okay. Despite the hype in the media about a shortage of milkweed, as I say, in California there is no shortage of milkweed. So planting milkweed may be a feel-good exercise, and it may be pretty, and you may be glad to have it. It's not going to have any significant impact on monarch populations, as far as we can tell. Hmm. One of the complications of all of this is the phenomenon of winter breeding, which we do not understand. Hmm. Normally, monarchs go into a condition called reproductive diapause in the fall, in which the males lose interest in sex and the females don't ovulate. So when they are overwintering in the trees along the coast, sex is not something that they're preoccupied with, okay?
That's good to know.
which makes perfectly good sense, because our native milkweeds go dormant in the winter and there would be no host plants to breed on anyway. We have a number of species of exotic milkweeds that don't go winter dormant and which are grown in gardens. The commonest one is tropical milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. And Asclepias persicica has been in cultivation in California since before I was born. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if it was only recently introduced. Okay. But it's only within the last decade or so that we have seen the phenomenon of monarchs breeding on it in gardens in midwinter. Now, the monarchs that are breeding in the winter are obviously not in reproductive diapause. They do not join the clusters overwintering in the trees. They act as if it's summer, and they fly around, and they mate, and they lay eggs, and they visit flowers, and they behave like there isn't any winter at all. And we don't understand what that is about. What we do know is the following. Number one, there's no native host plant they could breed on. So winter breeding is only possible, A, near the coast, and B, on exotic milkweeds that don't go winter dormant. Mm. Now, because there are relatively few such plants and they're all in gardens, they get used again and again in successive generations in places where monarchs are breeding in the winter. Now, this is not yet a problem in Northern California, but in Southern California, those plants being used again and again get contaminated with a protozoan parasite so that the caterpillars that feed on them get infected. And although it doesn't kill them, it reduces their viability and produces weak adults that may not be able to emerge successfully or expand their wings or fly. Authorities are advising people to get rid of their tropical milkweed so that they aren't encouraging this. It's not necessary to get rid of your tropical milkweed if you cut it back periodically to encourage new growth that isn't contaminated. But at any rate, as you can see, the situation is getting quite complicated. We have seen, as I say, during the monarch decline in Northern California, an increase in autumn breeding, but not in winter breeding. But now we have winter breeding every year in the East Bay, for example. And I suppose it's just a matter of time until the parasite problem develops here. It hasn't yet.
Wow, that's scary that, that all that...
If it ain't one thing, it's another. But I would dearly love to understand the context of winter breeding. As I say, the animals are supposed to respond hormonally to day length and temperature, just like birds do, and to become refractory to breeding in the winter, and some of them are not doing it anymore.
Yeah, so obviously that's a genetic change in them.
We don't know.
Yeah, oh,
we don't understand
true.
It.
That's true, yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
The work needs to be done.
Yeah.
To try to understand it.
I imagine there's not much money in those type of governmental budgets for those.
Oh, there's been a lot of molecular genetics done on monarchs.
Oh.
Identifying specific parts of the genome associated with migratory behavior, for example.
Hmm.
Now that, you know, the molecular genetic revolution has totally transformed population biology, population genetics, population ecology, even community ecology, so that someone who was trained when I was back in the 60s basically has to relearn the subject because the techniques brought to bear, the methods of analysis are now so different.
You've had to.
The guy who invented, you know what PCR is? Polymerase chain reaction?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it's a lab technique that allows you to multiply a small sample of DNA. So it has greatly facilitated molecular genetics by allowing easy DNA sequencing, easy, cheap DNA sequencing. Okay, well, the guy who invented it, Terry Mullis, got a Nobel Prize for inventing it, but he had no idea when he invented it, nor did the Nobel Committee know when they gave him the award, that he would be the most influential person in population biology in our time.
Wow.
That's not what he did. He's a biochemist.
Some have greatness thrust upon them.
Right.
Well, that's it. Time is everything, isn't it? And having the scope you've had, that knowledge, are people coming forward to, you know, are you, obviously, like the meeting you did yesterday, was there a lot of interest? And I'd love to know, if was there any questions that came up you hadn't heard before or something of interest?
Oh, nothing I hadn't heard before, but it was a very lively group, a very good discussion period. We had 200 people.
Mm. Wow.
So, you know, it was open to the public. Anyway, it was great fun, and as I said to the group, given all the fake news you get about the environment, it's good to stand up here and tell you what's really happening.
Well, that's it, isn't it? You bring the reality to it. That every time
we go cry.
To one of those sites, I mean, that is reality. That's another piece of data that for generations will be looked on and researched.
Yeah, well, we're providing baseline data. I'm obviously not going to be able to do this forever. I'm 72. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to do all my field work in a fairly short time, probably. I've already abandoned one site because it's too strenuous and my knees can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. But we have provided baseline data. So if somebody comes back and resumes the study, say, in 20 years, they have something to compare to.
It sounds like you're optimistic that in 20 years they'll be here.
Well, it would be nice. One of the people who attended my talk last night was an old friend who was retired from UC Davis. His name is Scott McLean, and he's a very interesting character. He's a historian of rock and roll and an expert on old German literature, among other things. And he's a Buddhist, and both of us are friends with the poet Gary Snyder, whom you have heard.
Oh, yes.
And Scott lives near Gary, and I hadn't had any news of Gary for a long time. I asked about him. Gary's 88 now. Hmm. But anyway, he told me a story about how Gary and Lawrence Ferlinghetti from San Francisco, mm-hmm. as the last two survivors of the true Beat Generation, right. were BSing in their role as Buddhist elder statesmen about whether the world would last forever. And they came to the conclusion, Scott said, that nothing lasts forever, but since nobody knows how long it's going to last, why worry about it?
I would say that's about the best philosophy you can have, I think.
I think so.
In terms of people want to find out more, what books should they read or where should they go?
Well, there is an excellent book recently published by a former student here and an old friend who is now on the faculty at Cornell. It's called Monarchs and Milkweed. The author is Anurag Agrawal, A-G-R-A-W-A-L. And it's readily available. And it tells the truth. Anurag tells it straight, and he's not part of the inner circle, the establishment monarch club. Mm. So he is willing to challenge the conventional wisdom when it's wrong, as it often is. So I love to recommend that book, Monarchs and Milkweed by Anurag Agrawal.
I really appreciate your time and your amazing work on this subject.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
And keep us aware, because as you know, they got little bells around their necks, those bellwethers of butterflies.
Well, let's just say, if there's a canary in the coal mine, they haven't been tweeting very loudly lately. Unlike some people.
Exactly, yeah. Thank you so much,
okay.
for your time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.